Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Tonight, I am pleased to introduce this evening's guest speaker, Aaron Gwynn. So Aaron is an associate professor of English at the University of North Carolina in Charlotte. His work stretches the spectrum from short stories to novels to creative nonfiction, which you may find in publications like McSweeney's, Esquire, and many more. Tonight, Aaron's here to present, is it your second novel? Second novel, just wanted to make sure. So Publisher Weekly, it was a really great quote that says, "This story is not for wimps." And it goes on a little bit, but the finish of that is, "But its gritty realism is part of the strength." So I think that is a pretty darn good thing to say about this book. And if you would please join me in welcoming Aaron Gwynn.
Thank you guys very much, and everyone from coming out tonight. There's always better things to do than watch somebody read out of a book to you, but you guys are sweet. I'm just going to read a short section, and then if folks have questions, I'll do my best to answer. He saw the horse before the rest of his team and thumbed the selector on his rifle to safe. There were eight of them hunkered behind the row of Hescos, eight rangers in digital camo, black knee pads and vests. Rifle rounds from the insurgents snapped against the wire mesh of the barricades, and he'd been watching, through a crack, the quadrangle of marketplace between him and the hostiles. Sandstone, pottery, a dry concrete fountain. And then the horse emerged from behind the burnt husk of a Toyota and walked toward the center of the square. Left hind leg, left front leg, right hind leg, right front leg. No hurry in its gait, no saddle or blanket, just a bridle and a set of split leather reins. Russell had seen plenty of mules in this country, a disheveled pony, but never a creature such as this. It was a varnish roan, dark brown on its cheekbones, elbows, and hocks, and if it was startled by the noise of gunfire, it certainly didn't show. The horse walked to the center of the quad and stopped. A hush descended over the square, and for several minutes, they didn't take any fire. The men behind him were peeking over the barriers and examining the animal through their scopes. 50 meters away, the horse snorted and stamped. It took a few more steps, ears pivoting left and right. Russell got his feet under him and rose to a crouch. His squad leader was a Texan named Cairns, and the man clapped a hand to Russell's shoulder and gestured. "They'll shoot that thing," he told them. "You see if they don't." Russell shook his head. The sun sat on the edge of the horizon, and the sky was suffused with a warm crimson light. Stars were beginning to show. He couldn't see a single cloud. It would have been a lovely evening but for the half-dozen men trying to kill them. He looked at the ground a moment, and then he raised his rifle and stared through the scope. Caught in the center of his reticle, the horse looked to be about 16 hands, and its conformation was very fine. He studied the horse's face and then walked the gun sight down its neck and across its shoulders and back. It wasn't a horse yet. Just a year and a half colt. How it got here and who it belonged to and why it had walked toward the shooting instead of away, Russell had no idea. He lowered the weapon slightly, blinked the dust out of his eyes, and then raised it to look again. He'd not gotten the scope to his eye when he heard the first shot. Just to the left of the crosshairs was a puff of gray talc where the round had struck, and he thought he could see the small cavity it had made, but he wasn't really sure. The horse took several steps and then stopped and turned to look in his direction. Russell felt his pulse quicken. The scope mounted on his rifle was a Trijicon ACOG with a magnification level of 4, and through it he could see the horse's eyes. He could see its lashes. The horse seemed to be staring straight at him, and before he'd lowered his weapon, he knew what he was going to do, and if it didn't get him killed, he couldn't imagine what would. He glanced at Carnes. "What did I tell you?" said the sergeant. "That's how dumb they think we are." Russell nodded. He slipped a hand in his pocket and touched the silver dollar he carried, then unslung his rifle and propped it against the barrier. He had 2 grenades in the pouches of his chest rig, and he took these out and laid them alongside the rifle's stock. He double-knotted the laces of his boots, and then he unsnapped his chin strap, took off the helmet, and set it on the ground upside down, placing the grenades inside. Cairns watched in confusion, and then vague comprehension, and then horror. The first words out of his mouth were, "Don't you even think about it," but it was already too late. Russell was around from behind the Hescos, moving at a sprint. Later, he'd not remember the gunfire. There'd be plenty of it, but he'd never recall a single round. There would be the feel of the dead September air on his cheeks, the packed earth against the soles of his boots. It seemed to muffle your footsteps as you ran. He'd remember the shouts of his teammates at the barricades behind him, Sergeant Cairns' voice deeper and slightly louder than the rest. Russell had only lowered his head. The blank odor of the desert surrounded him, and then, of a sudden, there was the scent of horse flesh, and the moment he smelled it, there was no team screaming for him to get down, or insurgents firing their rifles and automatic. There was only him and the colt. The animal had turned to watch his approach and then shuffled sideways a few steps. Russell slowed several feet from the horse, wanting to hunker, but knowing how the colt would respond. He stood straight as he could, face to face with the animal, and they began to rotate, the horse stepping to its right and Russell likewise stepping, like wrestlers circling for advantage. He extended a hand as slowly as he could, presented his palm, and began to make the clucking noises he had first heard from his grandfather. "Whoa there," Russell said, then gave the series of clucks, and the horse released a whinny and shook its head. The ground beneath their feet was a steel-colored powder, a few broken bits of sandstone, a few rusted metal shards. A half-demolished building stood 2 dozen meters away, ancient stone walls, Baroque wooden shutters, a minaret. The horse backed toward it. Russell thought if he could back it completely behind the walls, he might get them out of the lane of fire. But he couldn't. The horse continued to turn, angling them toward the square center, back into the open, and the sand popped at either side of him, craters erupting in the ground as the bullets struck and caromed back behind him. He reached for one of the reins and missed it, and he reached again and caught hold of the leather, doubled it around his left hand, and drew himself against the animal's face. He figured the colt would try to jerk loose from his grip, but the colt just continued to circle. Russell tethered to the animal now, and he could see for the first time the terror swirling in the horse's eye, and he himself reflected, distorted as in a funhouse mirror. They kept turning, Russell trying to seize hold of the other rein so he could lead the animal down a side street, get it far enough from the fighting that it wouldn't return. He was 75 meters from the nearest hostel, and he thought if the men who'd been firing at them were better marksmen, he and the colt would be dead already. He decided to release his grip on the rein and try to swat the animal to get it moving when something exploded behind him, and he was lifted on a warm cushion of air and slammed against the horse's side. When he came to, he was being dragged across the ground, and his left arm felt like it had been jerked out of its socket and was numb to the shoulder. His vision was blurred, and there was a loud ringing in his ears, and his entire body had the jangled sensation you get when you knock your elbow against a wall. There was the strong metallic taste of explosives in his mouth. His teeth hurt. He spat several times and then craned his neck to look behind him. The horse was walking sideways, its head cocked and its body crooked. It would take a few steps, tugging at Russell, and then stop and try to shake free of the rein. Russell could see the white of the animal's teeth, lips pulled away from the bit and working furiously. He was dimly aware of shouting, and when he brought his palm to his face, it came away wet. The horse took another step, jerked its head, and a sharp electric pain traveled the length of Russell's spine. He scrambled to his feet before he even had time to consider the action, and the horse immediately straightened itself and took off at a trot, Russell shuffling as quickly as he could, trying to run alongside the colt with his left arm still tethered to the rein. There was a stabbing behind his shoulder blade, and he reached with his right hand, grabbed a palmful of the animal's mane, and heaved himself onto the horse's back. He forgot the pain momentarily, and let the astonishment of what he'd just done wash over him. He was in northern Iraq, seated on a magnificent roan, and when his vision cleared and the world righted itself, he saw he was moving toward the enemy at a gallop. He fumbled his right hand down and took hold of the bridle and began tugging, trying to turn the horse. He'd never ridden with body armor, and he had no pommel to lean against, no stirrups to keep himself upright. He thought at any moment he'd be thrown. But he wasn't thrown. The horse sped slightly, and Russell flattened himself against the colt's neck and held fast to the bridle. He began to hear the gunfire now, the only he'd ever recall from the incident, and the horse dropped to a canter and turned down an alley between two partially destroyed buildings, ancient, massive. They went to the next street over and across that to another alley and then to another beyond. They emerged into a courtyard where several Humvees sat, U.S. soldiers with rifles at the ready, and the horse slowed to a walk, brought them into the center of the convoy, and then came to a stop. Russell eased himself upright on the animal's back. Stunned American faces stared at him from beneath their helmets. Iraqi interpreters watched cautiously, Iraqi policemen shaking their heads. Then a man walked towards them with a second lieutenant's patch on the Velcro strip above his sternum. He came to the horse's left side and looked up at Russell. "Corporal," he said. The ringing in his ears had receded to a low whine, and the word echoed twice. Russell cleared his throat to respond, but the rush of something came from down inside him. His last memory was the nicker of the animal as he collapsed against its neck. When Russell was released from the aid station 10 days later, he dressed in the clean uniform laid out on a folding chair beside his bed, gathered his belongings into a small plastic bag, and made his way across base to the squad's barracks, stepping carefully along the gravel walkways, his boots untied and the laces tucked behind the tongues. It hurt too much to bend over. His torso was an enormous bruise. He reached the Quonset hut, and when he stepped up the short cinder block flight and into the building, the men were waiting for him in a semicircle around the door. Someone threw on the lights and a cheer went up, and there were hands slapping his back and sides. Russell tucked his elbows to try to protect his ribs, but the men left off, took him by either arm, and ushered him to his bunk. They fetched a laptop, placed it on his thighs. Kearns was standing there over him. "Man of the hour," said the sergeant. "Yeah," Russell said. A soldier they called Wheels, Russell's battle buddy and a Texan like Kearns, lifted his hand to quiet everyone. He was very short with a scar that went up his forehead and pupils that quivered perpetually back and forth. Pale skin sunburned a bright red. Hair bleached almost white. "Let's see," he said, "if he'll tell us how it feels." Russell looked around at the expectant faces. He asked what was going on. Wheels bent over, palmed his knees, and stared at Russell. Then his brow went slack and he began to nod. "He doesn't know," Wheels told them, glancing at the others, then back at Russell. "You don't even know." "Know what?" said Russell. Several of the men chuckled. Watching someone return from the infirmary with a concussion and bruised ribs was apparently very funny. He wondered where they'd gotten their hands on liquor. Wheels clutched him by the shoulders. "You're famous, son." "You're drunk," Russell said. The men had crowded behind him on the bed, positioning themselves so as to see the computer screen. YouTube was open on the browser, a rectangle of video, and below it the caption, "Soldier Rescues Arabian." Wheels reached down and clicked a button, and the footage began to play. A man running along a street, the distorted chatter of gunfire. The camera followed the man until a horse appeared in the frame, and it took Russell a few moments to realize the person in the video was him. He sat there shaking his head. He asked where it was from. "Film crew on a balcony across the street," Wills told him, "BBC. Russell watched as his image took one of the horse's reins, and then as he and the animal began to turn. He could see the puffs of dust kicked up by the insurgents' rounds. He hadn't recognized how close he'd come to getting shot. And then the blast of the RPG, the rocket's vapor trail, and the explosion that sent him crashing into the animal's side. And then, briefly, a shot of him being dragged beside the horse. This was obscured by a building, and the camera searched left and right, and you could hear the cameraman asking where he'd gone. When the horse reemerged, Russell was on its back, and the camera tracked him until he went out of frame. And there the video stopped. Wheels said, "Been playing it on the news every 15 minutes. "They did a thing on your granddad," said a specialist named Bowen. "Guy on CNN. "CNN, said Wheels with contempt. "Talked about his being a ranger, your granddad. World War II, talked about his training horses." "Communist News Network," said Wheels. "Fuck they know about horses." Bowen studied the floor a moment. He was a Goliath from South Boston and had dominated the New England Golden Gloves circuit before joining the army. "They had pictures," he said, shrugging. "Everyone's got pictures," Wheels said. Russell ignored them. He clicked the button to replay the video, and when it was over, he just sat. "That's not an Arabian," he finally said. "What's that?" Wheels asked. "That's not an Arabian," Russell told him. "The caption says Arabian. Soldier rescues Arabian. That's an Appaloosa." "Jesus," said Wheels, "I want you to listen at him." Kern shook his head. He turned and made for the other end of the barracks. When the men tired of discussing the incident and went back to their evening routine, poker, email, a few of them reading a series of novels in which the dead became animate and rose to feed on human flesh, Kearns came back around. He had very blue eyes, jet black hair, and his Texas accent gave his voice a strange authority. He pointed at the edge of Russell's bunk. "You mind?" he said. Russell was lying on his back with his hands at his sides, trying to breathe as shallowly as possible. He opened one eye and squinted up at the man. He told him to be his guest. Kearns hitched his pants and seated himself, turned toward Russell, crossed his left leg over his right, and sat with his fingers interlaced, cupping his knee. "You feeling good?" he said. "You feeling satisfied?" "I feel all right," said Russell. "Lord knows," said Kearns, "we want our rangers happy." Russell stared at the man. He asked if there was something wrong. "Wrong," said Kearns, affecting a theatrical look. "Why would anything be wrong?" The blood in Russell's body seemed to slow. He'd known he was going to have to listen to this at some point. He just wasn't sure when that point would be. "Let me ask you something," said Kearns. Russell nodded. "What do you think the proceeds of your little stunt would have been if that grenade had gone off about 10 meters closer?" "I don't reckon I'd be laying here," said Russell. "No, I don't reckon you would either. In fact, I reckon you'd be laying someplace else. Maybe half a dozen places." Kearns' voice had gone red and the veins stood out on his neck. "Am I boring you, Corporal?" It wasn't a question, and Russell didn't answer it. "You pull another maneuver like that, you'll wish you deserted." "Roger, Sergeant." "I'll see you charged with insubordination. I'll see you in Leavenworth." Russell lay very still. He could feel the headache coming back on. "Are you a Section 8?" Kearns asked. "If you're a Section 8, just tell me." "I'm not a Section 8, Sergeant." "Why'd you do it? Don't tell me you don't know." Russell came up on his left elbow, but that was as far as he got. The headache was very sharp, and the pain in his side was like needles and pins. He took a few moments, and then he said, "I couldn't just watch them shoot the horse." Carnes stared at him. "Corporal," he said, "why are we here?" Russell shifted his weight, repositioned his hips, and lowered himself back against the mattress. "To provide overwatch," he quoted, "for our operators and support assets in direct contact with hostiles. Anything in there about rescue and horses or kittens or whatever the fuck else?" "No, Sergeant." "Are you a Section 8? "Negative, Sergeant." "Are you going to pull any more of this ridiculous shit?" "Sergeant, that's the first horse I've seen since I left home. I doubt I'll see another." Carnes scooted closer. "Corporal," he said, "are you going to fuck up my squad with any more of this dumbass behavior?" Russell took a short breath and released it. "Negative, Sergeant. I think that I'm done." But of course he ain't. So that's that part of that. Thank you for listening. I don't know anything, but if you guys have questions, I'll do my best to entertain you. Right. Right. Yeah. The question was about, do I prefer to write long form journalism, short stories or narrative nonfiction, creative nonfiction or novels? I prefer to write short stories, but no one reads short stories. And so, when your agent sells one, people inevitably say, "Oh, that's cool. We can't wait for your next book." And they don't mean book of stories by that. They mean novel, or something that actually happened. So yeah, I prefer the short story, but I'm one of 50 people in America who care about the short story. And
I love short stories.
You're also, so there's two of us right here in the same room. The odds of that are astronomical. Rob? Right.
The other part of this novel is also the horse stuff.
Right.
I know that you have some background with that, but can you speak to that element of the text a little bit, too?
So the question was about, I got all this military stuff. How do I get the horse stuff? So I grew up on a cattle ranch in Oklahoma, outside of a little community called Little. It's the name of the community. We had a feed store / gas station / like they sold cold cuts, two churches, and a cemetery. And the joke, though no one laughed at it, was that there were more dead people in Little than living people. So that was the closest. So, I mean, O'Connor said that she wasn't from a place. She was from outside a place. I'm from outside of a place. So I grew up on, we had a lot of acres. We started off with a whole mile section, then went down to 360, then halved that into 180 and so forth. And so I don't want to like come off like I think I'm some horse expert or like a horse guy or anything like that. But, you know, like growing up, we had cattle, we had show cattle and beef cattle. Guess who got to like get up at 4 a.m. and deal with the stuff that my grandparents didn't want to deal with? You're staring at them or listening to them. And we always had horses. So the stuff that went into the book is stuff that I grew up, knowing, doing, et cetera, where I had to get into research where I felt like I was on, less sure footing. And by the way, there's no one like equestrians to tell you that you've got some piece of tack wrong or the buckle should be. No one in the world is nitpickier. The military people aren't as nitpicky as equestrians, but, and good for them. Shit, man, I totally, like, lost my train of thought with that little digression. Where I was on less firm footing was, I got it back, horse training. I mean, the horses we had either already been broken or we just messed with them until we could ride them and do whatever with them. And so I went back and started looking at the birth of natural horsemanship And most of what guys practice today in that arena comes from a dude named Ray Hunt, who was really kind of revolutionary in his approach to training horses. And up until then, things had been pretty medieval and pretty hard on the horse. And, I mean, spurs were only the beginning of it. The horse didn't do what you wanted to do. You beat it until, you know, it started. And, of course, that doesn't work. Ray Hunt saw that immediately. So he took a completely different approach, and he said, you know, all you do is make the wrong thing work for the horse and the right thing relief for the horse. And that particular insight and expanding from that became an entire school of horsemanship called natural horsemanship. And you'll see that in guys today like Craig Cameron, who's a sort of pupil of Ray Hunt. The most famous is probably Buck Brannaman, the guy who they made the horse whisper about, but they made a documentary, it's a score just called Buck, about him, which is fantastic. Thank you. Sir, yes.
Other than parades, does the military use horses officially in the day?
Yeah, the question was about horses and whether the military uses them or not. I don't know about other branches besides the Army, but when America went into, or U.S. forces, U.S. Special Operations Forces, went into Afghanistan in the fall of 2001, a lot of people don't know this, they went in on horseback. So these are, I'll put Green Beret in quotation marks because U.S. Army Special Forces don't like to be called Green Berets, but Special Forces, and when you use that term in reference to American forces, that always refers to U.S. Army Special Forces, as opposed to the Navy SEALs or the PJs or Marines Special Forces, MARSOC or Scout Snipers, etc. They infilled from the north and met up with a force that was then calling itself the Northern Alliance. And those men used horses, and so we did too. So since we've been in Afghanistan, we've had a pretty robust horse program. There was a time very early on when men were actually Americans. Soldiers were fighting from horseback along with the indigenous peoples. That I don't know that things are quite that sexy anymore, but horses are used in Afghanistan because the terrain is difficult. Horses don't have to carry fuel. And there's a psychological, and they're quiet. And there's a psychological effect on the Afghan people. The Afghan people, they use horses, they use mules. And there's a sort of like connection with our special forces mounted on horses. Whereas soldiers getting out of an MRAP or a Humvee, you know, you have to think this looks like men from outer space to certain folks. So, yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, great question. Thank you. Right.
I'm not even going to ask the question.
No. How do you gun break a horse is what you're asking. All right.
Gun break a horse.
Yeah. Okay. Well, here's the thing. You can't gun break a human. Like no one gets used to the, you always have, like a startle, you know, you have a muzzle flinch. You're always going to have that. You can train yourself to the point where you deal with it, but you always have to deal with it. Guys who, you know, you're always going to have some amount of blink, some amount of startle. That is mitigated if you're using things like sound suppressors, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So with horses, what they do, I watch them do this. It's it's firing a gun 100 yards from the horse, watching it freak out, calming the horse down, getting closer, firing the gun, watching the horse freak out, calming it down. But as far as, are you going to shoot a rifle, from like a saddle, you have to expect you're going to end up on your ass. Right. I mean, even with a suppressor, I mean, you still need ear pro if you're firing a carbine through a suppressor. So, Yeah, you can't expect, I mean, horses are smarter than we are in a lot of ways. You can't expect a horse to just kind of just hang out there. So there are horses you can probably shoot from, but you'd probably be better off, you know, getting to cover if you want to start throwing rounds downrange, I would think. But yeah, they try to gun break horses all the time. There's no tried and true method as far as I've researched. And I watched people do it, and no one looked like they were having any fun. Especially the horse. Yes, ma'am.
Are you working on any new projects?
I am. I'm working on... real guy. Oh, I'm sorry. The question was, are you working on any new projects? So I've been doing a research on this cat who was born into slavery in the mid-19th century, a guy named Robert Lemons. And he was born West Texas, African-American. So this would be like 1849. When he was five or six, his mother took his brothers and sisters and left in the middle of the night and fled to Mexico. So he awoke as a kid, a slave, on this ranch. And so he goes from that sort of like position to, by 1875, he's the most accomplished mustanger, a breaker of wild horses in the world at that point. And he's the owner of a 1,000-acre ranch. And so the project I'm working on is a fictional sort of iteration of his life from birth to about the time that he marries. And he becomes a very, very successful, prosperous rancher. One of the many interesting things about him is that he learned how not only to break wild horses without touching them, but he learned how to break entire herds of horses at a time. So he would go out, wild horses are in an alpha system, much like wolves. So there'll be an alpha stallion that will control the movements of the herd. Lemons figured this out. So he would go out by himself, refuse to work with anyone, work with the horses until they recognized him as another horse. Right. And so he would get their smell on him, et cetera, et cetera. And then he would start doing things like he would be the first to lead the herd of horses off to a water source. He would watch how the alpha stallion had been doing it, and he would do it 15 minutes earlier. And then he would do it another. And so the horses would gradually begin to follow him until one day he would lead the entire herd of wild horses in off the desert to the ranch that he worked for. Kind of an impressive dude. All right. Oh, yes, ma'am. Right there.
So, speaking of short stories, Dog on the Cross was brilliant. Great book.
The question was, Dog on the Cross was brilliant?
The question is, can we ever hope to see those characters again?
Well, I just feel like right after that short story cycle ends, a tornado, you know, and everyone is wiped out completely. There are no survivors.
That makes me sad.
Except the horses.
That makes me
the horses
sad.
Made it out alive.
Sad.
Yeah, I'm sorry. The question was, is there going to be a sequel to Dog on the Cross? And there will not be a sequel to Dog on the Cross. I'm sorry. I'd be writing it for you. Which, I mean, ain't nothing. I may do that. But it'll just be for you, and you can have it, and that'll be that. All right, guys, thanks for coming out. I really appreciate it. You're sweet to come out on a Thursday night. Sweet to come out at all for a novelist. I appreciate it. Thank you.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.